Hello, and welcome to Swiss Literature Today, a series showcasing contemporary literature from Switzerland. This series is made possible with kind support from the Consulate General of Switzerland in New York and the Swiss Arts Council Pro Helvetia. In this episode, host Andrew Singer talks with Swiss-Italian poet, translator, editor, and literary organizer Vanni Bianconi. This episode features a full audio version of The Loveless House in multiple voices with music, composed by Dominique Legendre.
Vanni, hello.
Hello, Andrew. Hello.
Thanks for joining me. I understand that you are in London, and I hope you're kind of doing okay.
Yes, I'm in London. I'm actually in a hyper lockdown because I managed to injure my back. So what was a lockdown in my own flat, which, you know, is an experience we all know these days, suddenly seems a luxury because now I cannot leave my own bed. And so even the living room or the kitchen seems exotic and faraway places. So there is no end to this lockdown.
Yikes, a lockdown in a lockdown. I wish you Godspeed, you know, health with that. You know, I hope you get better very soon. And I hope you're feeling better soon. You have a kind of a multivalent career going here, so maybe we can talk about different aspects of your life and work. I guess you would be considered as a Swiss-Italian writer, is that right?
Yeah. I'm a Swiss. I'm from the south of Switzerland, so my language and culture is Italian. It's called Cantone Ticino. My town is Locarno. So it's a small area. It's like around 300,000 people. We, you know, south of the Alps, so there is the physical border, divides you from the German side of Switzerland, the French, and then there is the political border, which makes it one nation with the Swiss and separate from the Italians.
Although Italian is one of the four official national languages of Switzerland, I guess many people might not associate it as such. What is it like to be an Italian writer in the context of Switzerland?
Well, Italian, strangely enough, it was one of the major languages in Switzerland, you know, throughout the last century. And that's like a big occasion Switzerland missed because it was a lingua franca for all the migrants who came and built some big works in the country, you know, tunnels and highways. A lot of them were Italians and a lot of them were Spanish or Portuguese or from other European countries. And the language he would speak, it was Italian. So for a good part of the 20th century, Italian was a very widespread language. And so I'm not speaking about direct experience, but before my time, Italian was a power in Switzerland. So it was a national official language, but it was also a very lively language you will hear everywhere. And then this has been lost. People, you know, became part of their linguistic area, and the next generation learned to speak German. And the multilingual Switzerland didn't manage to cherish this strong presence of Italian. You will have, as I said, first Spanish people, Portuguese people, Polish people all speaking Italian. So yeah, this was in the past. So it's like a golden age for the Swiss Italian. Nowadays, as I said, it's a very tiny population. And basically I think our condition is always defined by negation, by opposition. You know, we are like basically almost two dimensional. We're like a line. If we go to Italy, we feel that everybody is very loud and speaks with their hands, and we feel that, you know, everything is very messy. And vice versa, if we go to the German side of Switzerland, then we feel that we speak with our hands and we are very loud and everything is too orderly. So it's, you know, we always, in a way, define ourselves by opposition.
Fascinating. It's a very unique experience that Switzerland is so multivalent in language. And then you too, in your career, you really are looking at different media and different forms of expression. Let's start with poetry. Do you identify yourself as a poet? How did you get started with that?
I can identify as a poet now because after my last book came out 2 years ago, after not having written a single line of poetry for these whole 2 years, more or less at the beginning of the lockdown, I finally wrote a poem. So I can boast now that I am a poet. But, you know, poetry comes and goes. I published 3 books of poetry. It started, just by writing, by trying to compress emotions in ways that were, as I think, synthetic and quick and significant as possible. And then I remember once a friend in high school showed me a poem that was not like the poems we were studying in school, showed me by accident a fragment of the 4 quartets by Eliot. And I remember how I connected to something that I didn't know existed before, and I felt I was trying to do something similar all along. So that's how it started, and I tried to imitate that, and then I kept trying to imitate other poets. One of those I understand we have a common passion is Winston Oden. So to get to the end of this quick trajectory, after a few books, after a few years without writing, now on March 20, when the lockdown started, had a very poignant, simple dream about being hanging up onto a bridge that was kind of raising above the water and having to wait that this bridge will get all the way up and then down. And this seemed to be so, once again, significant and synthetically precise to what was just about to happen, that I ventured into writing a poem after a long time. And I wrote the poem imitating a famous Oden poem, actually. The Oden poem is called As I Walk Out One Evening. And my poem, which I wrote in Italian, but I immediately translated into English because of this commerce between languages, which is compulsive to me. I also wrote it in English, and the and the English title is kind of a tongue-in-cheek, is As I Didn't Walk Out One Evening.
Is there any possibility that you could share that with us in English?
As I Didn't Walk Out One Evening. A Dream, March 20, 2020. The river is the Moskva. We take the underpass and walk across the bridge. It's March, the two of us. When we reach the river midst, the bridge divides in halves, just like outside this dream, the bridges on the Neva. We look into our eyes. We hold on very tight, but not to one another. We clutch the metal rail. It rises slowly upward. It will take long to peak, while everything we knew is more and more oblique. Gatherings of bell towers, statues of army generals, queuing for canned goods, queuing to get to hospital. If we see it all from here, oblique remains our look. We don't know what to promise, if we ever make it back. Hanging on, slightly apart, we cling on to this deck, just like outside this dream, your shoulder and my neck. Without knowing if or when, it will pick, hold, redeem, if we'll hold on, or why, just like outside this dream.
That was Vanni Bianconi reading his poem, As I Didn't Walk Out One Evening.
As I Didn't Walk Out. I mean, I hope the thing this poem does is push people to go and see the marvelous poem, which is As I Did Walk Out One Evening. Do you know the one? Of course you know it, no? It's a
W.H. Auden. As I walked out one evening, walking down Bristol Street, the crowds upon the pavement were fields of harvest wheat. That's the beginning of the Auden poem, As I Walked Out One Evening. And you've done an admirable job of capturing the rhythm and the form and the flow of the original poem, but updating it for your immediate circumstance. So that's lovely. The lockdown certainly put quite a punctuation mark in all of our cultures. You're locked down in London. Are you living in London these days?
Yeah, I live in London, and I've been here for all this time. So that was March 2020, and I've been here since early March, and in a solid lockdown, really. I work from home, so I think like everyone, I travel a lot emotionally and through newspaper pages, but physically I've been in till 2 days ago in the house, now in the bedroom. So I wonder what the next stage is going to be. I'm just going to be in a nutshell.
Right. Who knows? Maybe they can just synthesize you in a computer. They can download your essence, and you won't need to be localizable anymore. You know, you can just be software. Actually, on that same note, I mean, culture and these kinds of podcasts that we're doing, these kind of conversations, but literature generally is a way of traveling without leaving somewhere, and a way of translating experiences without physically interacting. And I know that you have worked extensively as well in translation. You've translated Auden into Italian, and also not only poets, but notable fiction writers like Faulkner or Somerset Maugham. What is the experience of translation for you as an author? What do you personally find wonderful about it, and how do you see that role of the translator?
Even here, like with the relation with poetry, it can be defined as controversial because, you know, I go throughout big stretches of time without writing poetry. I have to say that in these years I've been writing poetic prose or other stuff. I've been solidly writing, but not poetry. Same goes with translation. I started out of passion, just translating the poets I liked and I wanted to possess in a way, and I wanted to be able to steal every single penny out of their pockets. And then it became a job for a while, but lately I went back to translating just for passion because, you know, the occupations are many and time is short, so I'm a rather slow translator. And I, at the moment, haven't translated professionally for a while. And, but at the same time, I run a literary festival all focused on translation. So even, you know, if I, it's something I keep working on many levels.
Is that Babel, the festival?
It's called the Babel Festival of Literature and Translation. Website is babelfestival.com. And it's a festival focused on translation on all levels. I think we are one of the first one in the world to put, you know, not being just a... because festival now is 16 years old. Not just having conventions of translator, but really bringing the translator to a wide audience. So maybe I can also answer your question this way, because we think the translation... And when we started the festival... For example, no, 16 years ago, it seemed the translator were kind of a literature dirty secret. You didn't even know their names. They were these kind of very boring and pedantic people hidden in some attic. And then a lot of, I don't know, maybe in the US it was really a bit different back then, but in Italy it was definitely so. And in these 16 years, things have changed a lot. So now you have the name of the translator on the first page or on the cover of a book and so on and so forth. And what we did with Babel in all these years is to bring the translator on the stage with the author stay translated. And I can proudly state that I seldom saw such beautiful conversation with authors. You know, now literary events are widespread. Authors go for eternal tours and everybody is asked to, in a way, repeat things, because you cannot always make up new things. And I have to say that we translators, because their relation with the book is so precise, is so down to the syntagm and down to the syllable, and their questions are so heartfelt, and they suffer so much to get on the page something in a different language, and they have, you know, such an understanding and a painful understanding and joyful understanding of the original work, that the conversation are kind of astounding. And I have to say, the first year, so many people came to us saying, like, I could not believe to see how lively a conversation could have been with a translator. So a translator were considered human beings and able to think and talk in public. But also many people came to me to say, I saw this author in the past and he was just mumbling. But when you, I think, you know, this is what writers and translators are, people who work with the live nerve of language. And so they managed to touch that nerve to one another. And so the conversation on the stage is unique and is very strong. And I think this is the reason why we do this job, you know, to manage to get so close to a text that you can really understand how it is constructed, why the writer did a certain choice or why he could not make a certain choice. You know, sometimes you even find you find yourself in luck and you can do something better than the original because you realize sometimes what the writer wanted to do, or you have the illusion of understanding what the writer wanted to do. And maybe English or Turkish or whatever his language didn't allow him to, and you can do it in your language. So it's a very varied and adventurous practice, but of course it's very silent and solitary, so there are big contradictions. But yeah, it is an adventure and a beautiful job.
The Babel Festival is in Switzerland, that's right?
Yeah, it's Bellinzona, is the capital of Ticino, is just in between Zurich and Milan.
And in addition, you are now branching out and working in other genres, let's say, even other media. What has it been like to go from being a poet to being a lyrical prose writer and on from there? Formally, how does it give you more possibilities or change how you approach the act of writing?
Yeah, I think I keep writing to answer this question in a way. There are very strong instincts, like after publishing the last book of poetry, as I told you, I didn't write poetry and I started some projects such as The Loveless House that we're gonna talk about later, or nowadays I'm working on a book on wars. Up till a couple of months ago, I used to travel a lot and I would learn words and languages partially. And so in every place I went, I started to collect words. Could be India or Mexico or Brazil. And in each place I would find a word that would trigger my imagination. And then I would collect story about that word, speak with people, read. And so it's a collection of short stories or essays, each about where the main character is a word. Each text is very different, one from the other. So it's like a collection of stories where words are the protagonists. So I don't know why I had the instinct to do this with so many words. Actually, Faulkner maybe has a very simple explanation that would save me to go into many details. He once said that we all try to get down on paper what we want to say in, say, 20 words with a poem. If that doesn't work, then we're gonna give it a try with 20,000 words with a short story. And even if that doesn't work, then we really have to go the whole way and then use, 200,000 words and write a novel. So maybe it has to be something that has to do with being synthetic. But at the same time, I find it difficult to cut clear lines that divide what is a poem and what is a prose text. You know, it's a very, as clear is the instinct to write a poem like this we just read on the dream, or a prose text. At the same time, I keep having the impression what I learned with poetry, how to structure a stanza, how to create formal connection, how to keep a rhythm, and how to extend a metaphor. I think all of these tools that I managed to perfect or try and perfect in poetry, then they just come. It's like if you have you're riding a horse in a very tiny room, and then suddenly you can take the horse when you master it well enough to go around the room and have him doing what you want, and then run on a larger space, and the freedom of actually using the same skills but on a larger, more free kind of context. So maybe this is what is happening.
That makes sense. You mentioned this work, The Loveless House, and just as a heads up for our listeners, at the end of this episode, we're going to listen in full to a rather creative recording that was made, I believe you said, by Humankind Records. And so we'll ask you to set that up and tell us about it, and we'll go out with that. But The Loveless House has different incarnations or forms, and I guess on paper it's a short story, would you call it that?
Yeah, I guess it's a short story, or, when you start reading it, probably it's gonna look like an architectural essay. So it's kind of a hybrid form, but it is a short story, I believe, or a very long poem.
Or a lyrical prose. It certainly has a structure. It's certainly architected, and it has pictures as well, if I know rightly. Can you tell us more about how this work evolved and how it's structured?
Yeah, now it's strange because we are so near for you all to see the reason why I wrote this text, or the superficial reason I wrote this text, because if we were on Skype with a camera and if I wasn't paralyzed, I could just show you the image of this tower block called The Loveless House. Because it's a big housing estate just opposite my flat here in London. Yeah, it was built in the 60s, designed by Lubetkin, a Soviet emigre architect who built quite a lot here in the east area of London in Tower Hamlets. And he has very effective projects because with very low budget, he managed to create a dynamism he was a very idealistic architect. And this building is very imposing. It has kind of a star shape and is just towering over my flat. So I saw it terrible during the day and beautiful when it's lit up at night, and is always there, is a presence, and it's also where all the people around me live, actually. And so it has this potential of, to be like the town square where we should meet, where we should talk with the people in my neighborhood, and at the same time the frustration of this hope and this desire, because it's actually rather difficult to meet and to mingle and to talk. So this was the basic setting. Then one day I went in and I discovered that at its core, this star-shaped building has the most incredible staircase. So Lubetkin managed to build a angular staircase structure and then kind of a helical curving actually stair, which is very beautiful. It can even remind you of Sant'Ivo della Sapienza in Rome, something of a Baroque grace. And this for Dubetkin, it was a statement, it was an ideological stance. For constructivists, this was a social condenser. So you could save as much money on the material and everything, but somewhere you should create a space where the people living in rather small and dismal flat, they could get out and within their building meet and mingle. So that's why it's a social condenser, because it should take all the instinct, all the needs of socializing and getting together of people who, because of their social condition, cannot do that at home. Well, they have a place where that is actually encouraged. Is definition go from the very, you know, rational to almost mystical. And this staircase, it is a beauty, but as many of the ideals of architecture, is a complete failure. You can never see anyone, if not some crackhead sleeping on the stairs, if you're lucky. Otherwise, it's always empty and derelict. So I think this is the set of contradiction that trigger my interest for the Loveless House. And I actually try to meet the people living there. And then, you know, after many failed attempts in real life, I gave it a try in writing, actually imagining some sort of a decalogue, an ascent to the 10th floor with a person there and kind of eavesdropping onto conversation and, you know, carrying part of the real frustration, the real impossibility of mingle and be part of this house. But at the same time, the act of writing forced me to really listen carefully to the people and to meet and to imagine. So, you know, the writing about a failure can in itself be some sort of redemption of that failure, because just of the attention you pay to it, you know. Like, I think Simone Weil said that attention to the maximum degree is prayer. So in a way, maybe you cannot access the Loveless House, but you can pray for the Loveless tenant. And of course, Loveless House is his real name. That's what was another temptation that it was very hard to resist. Loveless.
The building was actually named that?
It is. It's written, you know, it's really nasty from outside. You will not call it beautiful, and it's written like big and clear. It's called Loveless House. It was a proto-trade unionist in Dorset in the 19th century, George Loveless. But of course, that's not what people will think of when they read Loveless House.
Terrific. The story itself, the Decalogue, as you call it, was commissioned for an anthology, and then it got turned into a sound piece. Is that right?
And the story is actually a little bit longer. I wrote a small book called London as a Second Language, where I am is a collection of, again, you know, lyrical essays or whatever, trying to deal with the adopted city. So the collection of that was published in English by an Italian publisher, Humboldt Press. That book was then given to other six writers living in London, but not English. And all of these writers were asked to write a text in response. So I wrote a text in response to my book, which is The Loveless House. And other writers, Sally Adonia, who is Eritrean-Ethiopian, Shalu Guo, who is Chinese, and Chloe Arigis, who's Mexican, etc. They all live here, plus a photographer who's Austrian. And they all wrote a text in response to London as a Second Language. And then these texts altogether were all translated into Italian and published by Humboldt. And then a London publisher, Influx Press, decided to publish it in English. So in last month, the anthology was supposed to come out in its original language, but then because of the pandemic, they postponed the publication. And but it's going to come out soon after all of this is over, I guess. And from this, then, when I was commissioned a sound piece, I decided with Dominique Lejeune of, it was about that project, the audio project was based on the planets. So we had to choose one planet, and we chose planet Earth.
Can you say the composer's name again, please, one more time?
He's a Trini composer from Trinidad and Tobago, who's been living here in London for a long time, Dominique Lejeune. So together we picked this text. I created a version for the piece, and then she composed the music. We had actors and various people to read the different parts, and we created these, I don't know, soundscape or dramatic music poem.
We're going to listen to the whole of it at the end of this audio, so that will be a real treat for listeners. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about one more thing, because one other aspect of your work is, I guess you have a multilingual web, literary web magazine called Specimen Press, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Specimen, the Babel Review of Translation. So this is a project, as you can see, they're all very related. So that's why sometimes I find it hard to see where one starts and the other ends. This pragmatically came out of the Babel Festival, because after 10 years of the festival, we had such a beautiful network of discovery of texts, of translators, of writers, of artists all around the world, that we decided we should activate this connection in a way that will create content that will stay and be accessible. And so we decided to, it was time to realize a modernist dream that was, you know, the multilingual magazine. In the early 20th century, you will have these monstrous publication trying to include many languages, but of course they had some physical limits. And well, now with the web, we can easily accumulate many, many different languages. So Specimen is a completely multilingual web magazine. Of course, there is a navigation menu, which is minimal, which is in English, but all the rest can be in any language. So there are texts that we never managed to access, but we just trust this network. We can have a, you know, a text in Swahili translation, translated into Russian or into Korean, or, and so we cannot even read it, but it's a lot of it, it's trust. And then many languages we can read, of course. And so the idea is this ever-growing rhizomatic collection of texts that, you know, they move between alphabets and they go in direction we cannot control, but then we can suddenly find after many translations when it comes back to a language we do know. And so it's a very, in a way, anachronistic project, because we have no images, no videos, so everything that you should not do on the web, we are doing it. We publish very slowly, like one content every 10 days. But we try to bring the care of the written page of, you know, typography and publishing onto the web. So it's a lot of challenges that seem to be from another time, and at the same time trying to make the most of the power of the web, where, you know, to see all these alphabets one after the other for, I don't know why, but we find it exhilarating. Now that you mentioned that the creativity there kind of was in a way triggered by this pandemic, after I had my dream, I wrote the poem about, the second thought I had was, well, dream is actually one of the way we have to travel right now. And so we went to look in the world literature of many encounters and travels in dreams, and we published a dossier immediately at the beginning of the pandemic saying, no, this is how I travel these days, because the idea is, you know, in literature, you can travel with literature, but within literature, there are so many dreams and so many strange encounters that, you know, take your body away when your body is confined. So that's one of the first things we published on Specimen during the pandemic.
So that's specimen.press. People can find it online, www.specimen.press. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. I hope people check that out. It seems like you've managed to make a fluid superstructure around you in different media, in different genres, in different cooperations, and in different ways that are just a continual outward expression of what is pouring through you.
I better do that, because if I'm, you know, I'm bound to become, as you said before, downloadable. I have to be able to travel throughout many medias, because the situation I'm in now, that's the only way I can go around.
That's wonderful. I wish you many more years of that kind of exciting fluid exploration and expression. Vanni, we're going to go out with this episode listening to the recording of The Loveless House, and this is out with Humankind Records. I just want to thank you for this very refreshing glimpse into what you're doing and your perspective on things. It really is something special, and I wish you all best with your back right now. You know, the lockdown within the lockdown, that can't be the best.
Thank you, Andrew, and I wish everybody the best with the main lockdown.
Loveless house, ground floor. The staircase, that Lubetkin staircase. Here, orbital flights of winders are framed within tiers of hexagonal landings. A ring is cut in thirds, then stretched from floor to floor, and finally redirected at each level to accomplish the full revolution in three stages, driving threefold patterns through space and leaving a cam-shaped vortex rising up the center.
The elevator is down and it's even talking shit. Do you hear it? But you come with me. Up those stairs, we have to get to the top of the building. I'll bet you 20 quid that the two people carved up there aren't saints. Aren't saints at all, just two fuckers like you and me, mate. This is Loveless House, yeah? This is planet Earth.
So I bet £20 and follow Gary up the stairs so the Loveless House is London, planet Earth.
Loveless House, first floor. The difficulties of truth amidst desperate evil.
Going to work anyway, didn't I? To show them. They told me you're mad. Go to the hospital, man. What are you doing here? You know, good people, my boss. They like me, innit? But now, 2 days, two fucking days, mate, and look at the arm. All swollen again. The boss saw it. He's the one who told me, go to the GP right now. Be back soon, he told me. Be back soon, he told me. But the doctor...
Loveless House, second floor. The possibility that love is not enough.
Same old rascal, taking the piss. 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 Same old rascal, taking the piss.
Loveless House, third floor. Honour this and that.
In my letterbox, I found it.
Found what?
The letter, you know.
I don't know.
Because I didn't put anything in the letterbox.
In your letterbox.
Moving your horrible cupboard there, that's how you found it. And he, the letter guy, had long moved out of the building altogether, and you decided that I...
Deeds alone decide for deeds to come.
Deeds alone decide for deeds to come.
Loveless House, fourth floor. An accent that has been described variously as Scandinavian, American, or Scottish. How formidable to hear what was just said. Voices all right, and as such almost deprived of body, and yet so much more palpable in their fear of losing a job, in the remains of a lifetime romance, reduced to door numbers and floors. The relation with the machine is a contagious one. The machine contributes to increase your automations and therefore reduce your humanity. That's what it does. And if a simple elevator prevents you from walking up the stairs and being exposed to your neighbours' noises and quarrels, pleasures and worries, imagine what is occurring now that the so-called AI plays a role in most physical and mental processes and assists you in deciding both your sleeping patterns and your sleeping partners. Loveless House, fifth floor, Saturday night and Sunday morning.
Madam, let me ask you again kindly. I had a long day, and the day has barely started. For most people, that is. I have been up since 5 o'clock this morning.
Five? Listen, sir. I got up at 4:30 myself, but I don't go around whining about it. Nor is a reason for me to go touch other folks' property.
Elevator is down. I had to climb all the way up. And the bright woman you are, you can easily tell I am past the flower of youth. If I was leaning on your windowsill, it would just catch my breath. I have no interest whatsoever in such trinkets, madame. I swear, not in the bathing the dwarf here, nor in the pretty mermaid there.
What I can easily tell you is that I know your type. Were we hit by a natural catastrophe, such as a broken elevator, God forbid, you is the type that sooner takes shelter in the pub, no matter how early it is, rather than finally do himself some good by walking up a few steps, as I do, every day, twice at least.
They do enjoy their quarrel, these two, tailoring insults from one another. You know, Gary, in my town...
Oh, shut up. Zombie Christianism, or whatever you choose to call it. But that's what you're made of. Two-dimensional pity. You tear your little pity square, lick it and stick it on the less fortunate ones. That's why you see saints up in my building, and you'll pay 20 quid for it.
Loveless house, sixth floor. Nolite temere.
Because the person ran down so fast and almost noiselessly, his steps pacing downwards from upstairs were just a soft crescendo that rose and whirled until he sped past between us like a wind, and when he was gone the sound he made was faint and fading, if almost, it seemed, dangerous. For some time we, this time I'm sure that Gary was with me, were expecting a second set of sounds from the floors above, people shouting in a rage or some brutal movement. There are events that rhyme. One first boot thrown on the floor, a car breaking, and the crash. Now the muted footsteps lapse that rhyme. Or they may be rhymed internally with all the varnished, unshouting doors overhead. And so, attuned to the unpredicted lack of pursuing noises, I started hearing the dialogue between the radio and the girl from quite a distance.
Loveless house, seventh floor. The icebox and the glacier. Glaciers to retreat. Alpine authorities have registered a significant increase in the number of human remains.
And I looked for it everywhere. I must find it. Or there. There I haven't looked. Is all I thought back then. I'd given up on it by then, though.
Bodies of Marcelin and Francine Dumoulin, who had disappeared after going out to milk their cows on 15th of August 1942.
Milk their cows! Took the milk bottle out of the freezer that morning, but didn't close it properly. At night, always defrosted and red to eat, the ice all gone. And where the ice was, there I found it. There I found it.
Out of the ice on Western Europe's highest mountain was a metal box containing precious gems, including emeralds, rubies.
Well, not in my ice box. I won't find that treasure there. But do I know where?
Loveless house, eighth floor, contentment. These are the primary objects of modern architecture, to improve by all means at the disposal of technique the living conditions of the people, and to create a language of architectural forms which, being firmly based on the aesthetics of our age, conveys the optimistic message of our time, the century of the common man.
Wrapped in a yielding air, beside the flower's soundless hunger, close to the tree's clandestine tide, close to the bird's high fever, loud in his hope and anger, erect about his skeleton, stands the expressive lover, stands the deliberate man.
Architecture can be a potent weapon, a committed driving force on the side of enlightenment, aiming, however indirectly, at the transformation of our present make-believe society, where images outstrip reality and rewards outpace achievement. Lover's House, 9th floor. Tell me the truth about love.
I just realized right this minute, I swear, that by taking her name away, I was fighting it. Even now, is the other name that comes to me, I have to make an effort to remember hers.
Names can be powerful spells.
I much hope my story sounded true to Gary.
Doors opening, doors opening, doors opening. Loveless House, 10th floor. The phone call.
Lift is broken. Lift is broken. That's not acceptable. We cannot use it and it talks shit. Can't stop talking shit. You must repair it urgently.
Loveless House, attic, dark.
I'm not even sure I'm following him. What could have made that noise? Who's moving next to me in the dark? A regret. But of course, nothing but ghost dancing. Calling out, though, is out of the question. A hand is on my shoulder now. My shoulder lifts with it. I press my face against the wall to get, with my hand, to the far end of the hall. I'm running my hand on the inner side of the bas-relief, what our bed was about, the two figures. And I'm breathing the concrete wall. Remember me, whispers the dust. What a better way to remember someone, something, than to breathe it in. The arms stretched upwards seem to touch gently, touch one another's skin to find it there, the first to fight, the force to endure. Who was here must have gone, and here I am. This is how it goes. One guardian must find a new one in order to be freed, and maybe I just fell into the old trap. Loveless porter, loveless caretaker, me. I don't take back my arm. I will one day.
This has been Swiss-Italian poet Fanny Bianconi in conversation with host Andrew Singer. You've been listening to Swiss Literature Today, a series showcasing contemporary literature from Switzerland. Support for this series comes from the Consulate General of Switzerland in New York and the Swiss Arts Council Pro Helvetia. This series is executive produced by Traffic Europe Radio. Thanks for listening.